Surprise! Yes, welcome back to the summer episode of Unfinished Business, the podcast which, well, I don't know whether we can loosely say we talk about anything. We haven't done a podcast for about as long as I can remember, which is not very long considering my advancing years. But the podcast that normally, when we do get around to it, talks about making a living in creative services and on the web. I am your occasional host, Andy Clark, and with me is my occasionally best friend,
Richard Rutter. Hello, Rich Rutter, actually, if you're my best friend.
Oh, dearie me. It has been a while, I've got to say. Sorry about that.
I've been busy on holiday, busy with work, and you've been away. And yeah, it's funny how the weeks march by and then suddenly, oh, we haven't done a podcast for a while, have we? We should really get back together.
I know. And it's funny because, you know, I listen to shows where they do, you know, multiple episodes a week sometimes. I mean, I've got into a new one with Michael Wolff called Inside Trump's Head, which I quite enjoy. And they do like two or three episodes a week. You know, I don't listen to many techie webby podcasts anymore, but I do still listen to Accidental Tech Podcast. And, you know, they religiously release a show like once a week. I mean, obviously, it's kind of mostly their business and, you know, they sell ads and promote and that kind of thing. So obviously it's dependent on them to actually make podcasts. Whereas with us, it isn't really. We just don't.
That's right. We get by through other means and certainly not through this podcast.
How is your long, hot, dry summer?
Well, yeah, we were on holiday for a couple of weeks, came back on Friday, and the lawn was yellow. It was desiccated, as you can imagine, 2 weeks without any water. So, and we've got a hose pipe ban coming tomorrow, so we've been desperately emptying the reservoir over the last few days to make up for it.
Well, we haven't got a hose pipe ban yet. But we're literally halfway through installing an irrigation system. I'll talk about a trip in a minute, but we went away and, you know, 2 weeks into our last trip to Germany, it obviously became hot everywhere. We found ourselves in northern Italy and it was 42 degrees.
Wow.
We hadn't gone away thinking there'd be a heat wave, and I'm watching my security camera, watching things die.
Yeah.
So in the end, I'm like on the Guanesca Village website, I'm like, will somebody please go and water my garden?
Yeah, it's same with us. We were in Mallorca for 2 weeks. We love going to Mallorca, but it was 10 degrees hotter than normal in Mallorca. Normally it's sort of upper 20s, which is just nice and warm. But yeah, it didn't drop below 35 during the day. And it got humid in the second week as well. So it was pretty nuts. It's fine while you've got nothing to do while you're on holiday, but
yeah,
it felt lovely and cool coming back to 25 degrees.
Well, we're going away again next weekend and we won't be back for about 6 weeks. It'll be the middle of September when we come back. So you have to marvel at my fabulous DIY plumbing skills, because yesterday these hands that are so delicate and so artistic and, you know, they're almost like piano players' fingers, managed to fit a brand new outside tap.
Wow.
I learned all about how to turn the water off and about how to unscrew the old tap, put what they think is PTFE tape, some sort of weird stuff around the threads, and screw on the new tap. And my biggest problem, though, it went on perfectly and it doesn't leak and it's great, but it's about 5 degrees off straight.
That's annoying.
And I turn it enough to make it perpendicular. It's just at that last kind of squeak of the threads. But if I turn it back so it's straight on the previous turn, it leaks.
Yeah.
So what do you do in that situation? I've got no idea.
I'm not sure. Maybe wait till it gets really cold, because then maybe things will shrink and you'll be able to move it a little bit more.
Possibly. I whacked it with a hammer.
Yeah.
So we've got trouble. We've got the new tap. We've got one of those battery-operated timer widget dingus devices.
Nice. Oh, good job. And that's that special porous hose pipe. It's not an old one you've just drilled holes in, presumably.
No, it's like we've got 100 metres. Like, it's not even a big garden. 100 metres of this porous thing. So tomorrow, as well as going to see The Odyssey at the cinema, I will be having a hose pipe odyssey and a journey to try to finish my irrigation system.
Went to see The Odyssey Wednesday evening. It seems lots of people are going to see The Odyssey. So I went with my wife, Wendy, who is a classics teacher, and it got her stamp of approval, which these things don't always. I'll say no more other than I enjoyed it too, all 3 hours of it. It didn't feel, you know, sometimes like a three-hour film really feels like a three-hour film, but it didn't. It felt like maybe 2.5.
I love this thing where people go, you know, no spoilers. I mean, Jesus, you've had 3,000 years to read the book.
Yeah, and I mean, I knew a fair bit of it anyway, but I did read Stephen Fry's book, The Odyssey, which is not a translation so much as telling the story. He sort of tells the story of the story in a way where the poem itself is like the first part. You have Odysseus relaying some of what's happened to him, which, spoiler alert, is not actually in the film. It's one of the bits that they sort of missed out, that it doesn't, it's immaterial. So like in Fry's book, he talks about how that was happening in the poem and then talks about what Odysseus actually said. So you find out, you know, the story. It's really good. It's a good book. I recommend the read. It's very accessible. Stephen Fry's writing always is.
Yeah, so we're going to go and do we're going to smuggle snacks into the cinema, which is usually the thing to do. I remember years ago, there was like me and Sue and Alex, we went to see something. And I had a big coat on and we'd stopped off at Tesco's on the way in because, you know, we weren't gonna be paying the inflated prices that the cinema charges. So we get stopped on the way in and I've got big pockets in this coat. I've got my hands in my pockets and I'm out here with, you know, with crisps and Maltesers and all of that. And the guy stops and says, I'm sorry, sir, but you know, you're not allowed to bring your own refreshments into the cinema. And I said, what refreshments? This is all me. He let us in. But then throughout the film, there was this one light. It's true, it was a coincidence, but there was this one light that kind of stayed on above us as if we were like sucking Doritos, trying to eat them silently.
We brought in some bottles of water because I had a 500ml can of Coke was £3.50 and a 500ml bottle was nearly £4. I mean, I can understand paying £7 for popcorn. I'm not paying £4 for some Coke.
So that's what we're going to do. And then I'm going to finish my irrigation system. And hopefully that's going to help keep the garden alive while we go on our next little odyssey.
Yeah.
We had a sort of four to five week trip. We went to see Alex for a week, and then Sue and I took a train to Berlin, and I spoke at a conference, which I'd been invited to speak at.
Ooh.
Which we can talk about if you like. It was a weird experience, and I said for a while, you know, I'm not gonna do conference talks anymore. It's kind of, you know, I don't want to put myself through that stress and. Anyway, I got invited and I thought, yeah, it'd be quite nice to have an excuse to go to Berlin. And, you know, if somebody's prepared to pay for the transport and a hotel, then, you know, then that's great. So anyway, it was the weirdest event that I've ever spoke at. And it's now increased my resolve that I'm not going to bother speaking at any more conferences.
What was weird about it then, Eric?
It was a strange one. It was a company. I don't want to disrespect anybody. Thank you for inviting me. But it was a company that puts on conferences. So it wasn't like, you know, Mark Thieler or you or, you know, Vitaly that, you know, it's an aside to what they do. Or it's a personal passion. It's a company that puts on conferences.
Yeah.
You know, 2 weeks after that, they were doing the same event in Munich.
Okay.
So we get there. And I think I'm speaking at like 11 o'clock. So we get there at like 10 o'clock just to kind of go say hi to everybody and, you know, whatever. And he gets the break time, which is, you know, a few minutes before my talk. And there's like, it must have been about six people appeared. And it's one of these things where it's not like one big stage and one single track. It's multiple small rooms. So by the time that it comes to my session, you can get more people on the top of a double-decker bus than were in the room when I was speaking.
Yeah.
It felt a bit odd. And then Sue and I, you know, we left straight away after the talk and got back on our tourist bus because there was, you know, there was nobody to kind of mingle with. And then we got back on our tourist bus and went and did some museums.
Right.
Yeah, so it's a weird one, but it didn't give me... I was thinking, well, maybe, you know, maybe it will kind of enthuse me to, you know, do more talks. But it did quite the opposite, to be honest. But we had a lovely time in Berlin.
Sounds like you need a different conference organizer to enthuse you.
Yeah, as I you think say, that's yeah, probably like, right.
Clear so, you know, if, Italy. Yeah.
But we had a nice time in Berlin, got the train back, had another week with Alex, and then we decided that we weren't going to come straight home because there was no point. And Sue's brother actually lives in northern Italy, so we went and we drove there.
Lovely.
We had a night in Luzerne on the way down, which was a beautiful little place. I can really, really recommend Luzerne if you ever find yourself in that part of Switzerland. I could nerd out at the expensive watch shops and take pictures, which was nice.
Yes.
And then we had some days in northern Italy around Como, and then we did the big schlep home. And of course, along the way, I picked up the Cinar 5x4 camera that I was showing you before we started recording.
Yeah, 5x4. So that's the negative size then. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, which is about the same size as we used to print out photos.
Yes,
wow.
Exactly. 5x4 inches, not 5x4 centimeters as well.
Yeah, exactly.
So it was a weird one because this is, I'm nerding out about this, but I said that I would buy one of these cameras when I grew up if I could ever find one, because it was the camera that played a fairly pivotal role in my kind of, you know, early working career. And it meant a lot, and it was very nostalgic. And I always said, you know, when I grow up, if I can find one, I'll buy one. And then a couple of weeks before our trip, Alex was in Vienna and was walking past the camera shop, and there in the window was this thing. So Alex is FaceTiming me frantically, excitedly going, is this what I think it is? And it was.
Wow.
And it's an
well spotted.
Absolutely mint condition. Not a single scratch or mark on it. It looks like it's just come out of a box. So I ordered it and it came. So we had it delivered to Alex's, and then I smuggled it back into the country.
Are you intending to use it? Can you even buy film for it nowadays?
It's much, much easier to shoot black and white, because you can process at home.
Yeah.
But there are various adapters that you can shoot other formats with it. So actually, it came with a 5x7 centimeter roll film holder. So the sort of 120 film that you would put into a Hasselblad or Mamiya.
Yeah.
So you can shoot medium format film with it. And some enterprising Chinese people have made an adapter back that you can put a DSLR onto.
Yeah.
And then you can use the Graflock adapter on the back. You take the ground glass screen viewfinder off and you put your DSLR. Yeah. I bought it because it means a lot and because of nostalgia.
Yeah, just a lovely object.
It's just, so it's going to sit in my studio, and every time I walk past it to go up and down the stairs, I'll just kind of turn one of the gears and just, you know, put a bit of swing on the front or take a bit of tilt on the back or something like that. But it's weird. The company, they went out of business years and years and years ago. There's a photographer in Munich who I'm going to go and see when we go on our next trip that bought all of the spare parts or the remains. They ended up being owned by Leica, your favourite camera brand.
Yes.
which would have seemed like a really good fit because you've got the highest end of 35mm and the highest end of large format. So you would think that it would be a really good match, but apparently Leica didn't know what the hell to do with Cinar, so they ended up selling off the bit.
Yeah, that's a shame. Perhaps a missed opportunity, but yeah, I mean, with DSLRs and so on, such a shrinking, very, very specialist audience for stuff like that now, I guess. It still does exist.
Are you still shooting on your Leica?
The only Leica I've got is a compact. My film camera is an old Canon. As much as I do love Leicas, I've never really owned one apart from a little compact, which is digital, too, which is probably, if I'm really honest, a badged Pentax with a Leica lens on it, supposedly. But yeah, I've still got my old Canon, which I bought when I was a teenager, so it's fully manual, no autofocus even, anything like that. I mean, not fully manual, is you know, there's sensors, but there's manual focus and stuff, so...
I had, yeah. It's not a T90, is it?
No, it predates the T90. It's an A1, and the T90 came along. That was a classic, the T90, though. That was fantastic. And actually, the person I bought it from, I think it was my mum's cousin, they bought a T90 and sold me their old A1 back a long time ago. And yeah, I've been looking at the A1 bodies in camera shops sort of ever since, and they've stayed at the same price, which obviously means that they've actually decreased in value. But they have stayed at the same price, which is about £100 or something. So it's not like they're expensive gear.
No, I love my T90, but it ended up kind of gathering dust, and I eBayed it many, many years ago and kind of regret having done that. But I'm actually going to shoot portraits. I'm doing some portrait photography this weekend in our local church, and I'm going to shoot that 35mm. I'm not gonna lug my Cinar into the church.
So with a large format like that, does it have kind of normal sort of shutter speeds and things like that? It's not ridiculous, like a Victorian shutter speed or something.
No, I mean, it depends on the lens. I have to take the camera apart to see what the lens is. A lot of it depends on the aperture.
Yeah.
So large format lenses very rarely went down below 5.6.
Mm-hmm.
So if you do use them now with a smaller film format or a digital back, they won't be pixelated, but there's a sort of a softness to it because the lenses are designed to produce a big image circle, not the very focused beams of light that you need to focus down onto a CCTV. But yeah, interesting. It was a weird story because, you know, they were the pinnacle of large format up until the mid-90s, and it all changed when digital came along.
Mm. Yeah, so it must have changed very quickly then, right?
Yeah, it was, because I remember it was probably around about 92, 93-ish, and the first professional digital camera back came to the UK, the Leaf DCB. And Cinar's approach to digital photography was that if you want things quickly, because that's what they thought digital was about, and you don't want to have processing or, you know, scanning fees or whatever, then their solution was to buy a 10x8 camera. 10x8-inch camera with a 10x8-inch Polaroid processing machine and then to shoot instant film.
Right.
So obviously that was their kind of initial kind of reaction to digital. It's never going to take off. You're never going to get the large format quality. But pretty soon people realized that you didn't need that large format quality for the vast majority of things that they shot. So Cinar did end up making adapters for various different digital camera backs. Yeah. And then they ended up making their own digital camera backs. But these things were kind of quite chunky themselves at the time. And by the time that you kind of put them onto a P2, which is the camera that's sitting behind me, it was a huge beast. And the P2 was kind of over-engineered just for putting a digital back onto. And although they did make a smaller version of it for digital backs a few years later, they kind of missed the boat.
Yeah.
People realize that actually, you know, it's much more convenient to put it on the back of a Fuji GX680 that had a little bit of kind of tilt and swing on the lens, or to put it onto a Mamiya RB67 or something like that. It was much more convenient than going through the aggravation of, you know, adding it to a P2.
Yeah.
So they kind of missed the boat. They could have, and they should have, really thought further forward and thought, you know, hey, we need to make digital cameras. But they never really got it. And, you know, that was the end of them, which is very sad.
Mm.
Well, I think it's sad.
They won't be the only ones at all, will they, who didn't quite grasp that. And digitization of all sorts of different things as well. People would have gone by the wayside. I mean, even, you know, the likes of Kodak, stuff like that, never really kind of worked out what they're going to do instead.
I mean, you know, we're going back to nostalgia time now, but this is going back in the 90s. And I'm heavily steeped in digital photography at this point. I've been working for Cytex with the Leaf, and they decided that they didn't want to be selling digital cameras themselves. They were going to put it all out through dealers. So they introduced me to one of my best friends now, Joe Simons, who, you know, he ran a business that sold digital processing equipment. So the camera was a good fit for them. But meanwhile, Kodak had brought their own digital camera backs to the market. Now, bearing in mind that only maybe 2 years before that, Kodak actually put out a business strategy document which said that their future was selling film in China.
Huh.
If we can sell one roll of film a year to every family in China, we'll make, you know, gajillions.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, they were looking for somebody to run digital photography at Kodak in the UK. And there was a job which I applied for. And I went for this interview in Hemel Hempstead, this Kodak headquarters. And I remember going in. The lady said to me, well, before you have your interview, there's a questionnaire that we'd like you to fill in. And it was, I didn't really know anything about this. It was one of those Myers-Briggs tests.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you've got 30 questions and 30 minutes or something like that. So she came back at the end and said, you know, have you finished your questionnaire? I said, no, I didn't start it. So she was all flustered and then took me through to this interview room. And there's like half a dozen people that I know. And there's all these Kodak guys in suits, most of which I knew from, you know, from conferences or, you know, exhibitions, or I'd beaten them in deals or whatever. And she went in and she said, he won't do his questionnaire. And I said, it's bollocks. You know me, I've beaten you and you in deals worth like, you know, £500,000 over the last sort of 3 months or so. And you want me to fill in some stupid test? You know who I am. And anyway, weirdly, I didn't get the job.
Well, but maybe a blessing in disguise.
probably was. But Kodak was another company that completely missed the boat. They couldn't read the tea leaves at all.
Well, also, it's a slightly odd business strategy if that was the case, where you think, I will try and sell film to China, and no one piped up to say, but doesn't China make all of the digital cameras? And isn't something going to happen there with the population of China? They're not going to export every single digital camera, are they? There are going to be some cheap ones coming out of those factories, because that's what China does.
I think I was talking to a photographer the other day, because he's actually going to hopefully buy a C9 accessory off me that I bought that I don't need. And it was actually really interesting talking to him about what professional studio photographers use now, which is so different to what they used back when I was involved in the industry in the mid-90s.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm guessing it's all just digital SLRs, like 35mm sensors or something like that. But
Full frame SLRs. Some people will use digital backs that are, you know, kind of roughly Hasselblad format.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. I suppose it's got the same warning signals, I suppose, as, you know, what we're talking about in this industry with AI, particularly in software development. Mm-hmm. It's that You know, if you're a software developer that's, you know, working for a big organization like Shopify, I'd be looking for my next gig.
We did a project at ClearLeft recently, which we're going to launch soon. It's a free tool for kind of checking and adjusting the hues on color palettes to make them accessible. So kind of the way it works is you input your brand color palette. It'll say which combinations are accessible, which aren't, but then also give you an adjustment to those colors. So that, like, here's the same color scheme, here's the same palette, but we've adjusted the colors slightly. So now that they are accessible and they will pass. And it's just a little free tool that it's one of those like itch that we were scratching for ourselves and thought, oh, let's just polish this up a bit and we'll chuck it out there. So we're just doing a few bits of sort of bug fixing. So we'll get it out there soon for everyone to use. But the point is, we did a kind of a sprint on that in terms of like, let's design it and build it. And the build, kind of unsurprisingly, was done with a lot of help from Claude. And our developer, Sam, who was working on it, says there's no way that he could have done it as quickly without that help. But he was quite careful in terms of how he used it, so that at least, you know, going through and checking it worked. And also the code it's produced, was able to understand it and would be able to go back to it. Because that's the problem that we came across on another little project for a university recently, where we inherited code that had clearly been vibe coded. And it was an absolute indecipherable mess. And we wanted to make a few little changes. And yes, we could have kind of, in a meta way, got Claude or something else to like have a look at this code, help us understand it, and then make a change to that code. But we kind of, it's like just a trivial thing we wanted to do. It's like we couldn't make head nor tail of it because it had just been vibe coded. It worked. It did what it was supposed to do, but it only did what it was supposed to do. And was just impossible to take on, you know, far more difficult than taking on a human's or undocumented code, because you can pick that apart a bit better. So it's kind of the good and the bad. But yeah, at the end of the day, as you were saying with the software engineering thing, there are two sides to it, but we're able to make this thing much more quickly than we would have done in the past, which makes me shiver a bit. Also, you know, it has to be a good thing, but it does.
One of the things that I did while we were on our last German trip was I did major surgery on the Stuff and Nonsense website. And this thing, you know, it was donkey's years old. It was one of those sites that had gone from kind of movable type to expression engine. And then it had gone from expression engine to Statamic.
Right, yeah.
And also, I never really fully understood how Statamic worked. You know, the template structure and various things kind of baffled me a bit. And when I'd added, you know, little kind of side projects to it, I just added them in as a flat HTML CSS folder.
Yeah, yeah.
So there was no shared anything, headers, footers, whatever, across the whole site. So it clearly needed some work. It had so many bolt-ons that, you know, there was very little left of... In fact, the only thing that Statamic was really doing was the blog. Everything else was essentially just, you know, hard-coded into templates.
Yeah.
So I thought, this needs fixing. And then also, Stephen Grant, who has been one of my developer partners for well over 15 years, built the site originally in Statamic. He decided, bless him, to move to New Zealand, which really didn't cause me a problem until there was a problem.
Yeah.
We had a few instances where the DigitalOcean server that he'd put it on fell over. So it would take 24 hours for me to kind of get things back up again. So I thought, right, this thing needs fixing. It needs rebuilding. And of course, doing it in 11T was the right thing to do. But I've got well over 1,000 blog posts. I've got all of the hard-coded stuff. I've got the additional folders and portfolio bits and everything else. So it just felt like one of those jobs that you'd start and kind of never finish.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I decided that I would give it a go. And I've become a huge user of Codex, which is ChatGPT's Claude thing, which until recently, until they fucked around with the apps, worked really well. So I said to Sue, right, you know, look, you know, we've paid Stephen for the year. We're not going to be, it's not going to cost us anything to keep the site where it is until, you know, next January. So if it takes me, you know, 6 months to migrate the site, then, you know, so be it. But actually, it took about 3 days.
Huh.
It was nuts. It was so clever in that I would ask it to do something and then it would say, oh, and by the way, I've also found this folder of old archives. I'll make sure that they have the same headers and footers as well. So the thing was so streamlined. It was incredible. So I'm a bit of a convert, really, when it comes to, sorry to all my development partners who I've used for donkey's years, but Codex did it for me.
Yikes. Yeah.
Well, like you said, with like Sam was saying, you know, I understand the code that it wrote. I gave it lots and lots of guardrails and said, this is how I want my code structured. I don't want you to do all of the things that AI coding tends to do. You know, if you ask it to write HTML, it tends to litter it with classes, or, you know, if it knows that you're concerned about accessibility, it'll put ARIA labels on absolutely everything.
Yeah, yeah.
So I did have to kind of, you know, train it to do things how I like them to be done. But it was pretty epic.
Just speaking of Sam, he wrote a really interesting, good blog post on the Clear Left site. Maybe we can put a link to it in the show notes. But it's called A Considered Approach to Generative AI in Front-End Development. Snappy title for a blog post, but it is what it is. And he just kind of
did AI write that title?
I think that's the Sam title. But yeah, he goes through his sort of thinking and is where he'll go and where he won't go. And it's, like I said, it's his considered approach to it. It's Clear Left, we like to sort of straddle to give people enough leeway to do things as they see fit, but just within sort of guardrails and boundaries. And we're still trying to define what we believe those are, because there is a little bit of a spectrum of that within Clear Left. Certainly if you talk to Jeremy, he's very much down one end, and then other people are a bit more free and loose with the use of generative AI. And there's a point in the middle where I think we can be comfortable and make sure that we are making the best use of it internally. And our clients are using AI and asking us about it all the time. So see, we're able to provide advice and so on through. And you can't do that without actually using it to some degree yourself. But I don't think our jobs are going to go away because of that. That's maybe a conversation for another day.
Yeah, it is, because I've been sort of ruminating on the fact that it produces what I've been calling commodity code or commodity designs.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, if you ask it to write you a tabbed interface, it's going to have learned what tabbed interfaces are coded like, and it'll give you exactly the same. If you ask it to give you a picture of smiling business people shaking hands over a salad, it's going to do exactly the same thing. It's that, you know, it's very generic commodity stuff. But
yeah, and there'll be a group of white people unless you specifically ask otherwise.
Ethnically diverse business people smiling and shaking hands over a salad.
Yeah.
But that's not going to replace, I think, the human aspects of the storytelling and everything else.
Yeah.
I've been working on a couple of projects recently, and they are redesigns of old sites. And I have actually, just purely as an experiment, said to ChatGPT, I'm working for this type of company. Here's their website. What you know about my writing style and how I like to present things, give me an appraisal of what you think their copy is like. And it's been incredibly good, actually. So I have, for my sins, used a little bit of that generative output purely in the prototypes that I'm making.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not because I think it's going to be finished copy that the client's going to sign off, but because it's a damn sight better than the crap that they've already got.
Yeah. I mean, for years we've had that where you you know, even back in the day when they're producing wireframes, we don't really do conventional wireframes much anymore. But we would tend to avoid doing lorem ipsum because that doesn't tell you much about what you're wireframing. So you put something indicative in there. And whether that's microcopy around form labeling, which actually might be our responsibility, but then other indicative copy. And the number of times that gets used because the client looks at it and thinks, well, that sort of makes sense. If we don't use it, someone's got to write it. And I know who, so our copy ends up on the website and become quite aware of that. And yeah, we change our approach slightly. So it's a bit more deliberate when it comes to the words that come from us and end up on the website. But yeah, those starting points are quite useful.
Yeah.
And it, yeah.
Anyway, I'll say, give me 10 different headline suggestions to describe. So yeah, no, I think it's interesting. I think it's going to be, we're going to talk about this another day, I'm sure, but it's definitely the kind of the topic of the moment for people. Hence the fact that the company that invited me to speak in Berlin actually asked me to speak about AI in the design process.
So oh, right. Interesting.
That was what I was there to impart to half a busload of people.
Well, one of the things that happened, I think, since we last spoke was our UX London conference that Cliff organises every year. And Jeremy Keith curates that really well. And but what was interesting is there were no talks, not really any talks that specifically spoke about AI. AI was alluded to in some, but there weren't any AI talks, not even AI in the process. And that was deliberate, and a lot of people kind of applauded that in feedback forms and things like that. But what was evident was that going around talking to attendees in the breaks, that was still what everyone was talking about. But I think people were just glad that they didn't have to listen to it as well as then talk about it in the breaks. But I'm not sure we can do that every year because people do want to know stuff. And things like you just said there, like the within a design process, it's in the way that we would have talked about other things in terms of design process a few years ago. If people want to know, design processes move on and they want to know, you know, what to do, what's best. And so if that's going to be part of the design process, it needs to be part of the conversation.
Yeah, no, we'll come back to this, I am sure, over the next kind of weeks and months. But yeah, it was interesting. Yeah, I remember a talk. You might remember him giving this, but there was a talk. Oh God, it must have been 20 plus years ago now that Jeffrey Veen gave.
Uh-huh.
Where he talked about industries that came and went when the situation changed, like the fact that before refrigeration, none of the companies that used to cut ice in Canada and, you know, in the Arctic and then ship it on boats to, you know, the Americas or India or wherever, none of those companies ended up making refrigerators.
Yeah.
When the Americans...
They mistook their purpose as being what we do is find ice and transport it, as opposed to we help people keep things cool.
Yes. And then there was another example that Jeffrey gave, which was banking and how, you know, when the American gold rush happened, lots of people went west to make their fortunes. But in order to actually pay for the trip, they borrowed money in the east and then had to pay it back. Well, the only way they could pay it back was in gold because that's what they dug out of the ground. So hence you've got skis which would traverse the continental US taking gold from the west to the east, which of course was a real pain in the ass and got robbed and, you know, everything else. Actually realized that actually why are we shipping this gold back across the US when we can keep it in California and then just write promissory notes that say, hey, I've got the gold, it's worth X. And that was the kind of the origins of the kind of modern banking system. And the only company that actually survived that transition was Wells Fargo, which is a bank in the US.
Yeah, I do remember it as well. Maybe we should get Jeff on the podcast. I haven't spoken to him for a long time.
No, I haven't, actually. I think the last thing I heard was that he was at, like, you know, some venture capital business doing venture
capitalism. Yeah, but
based in
London, I think, personally. And it sounded like it wasn't so much the... I mean, venture capital is venture capital, but I think there is there's a bit of a spectrum of bad to not quite so bad. And I think Jeff was down at the not quite so bad end.
He's not making autonomous killing machines.
Well, last time I spoke to him, he definitely wasn't, but, you know, it's been a while.
Funding autonomous... Funding autonomous killing machines.
No.
Yeah, that would be a good choice. Well, what I want to do, I think we've got a guest, Veronica, coming up on our next scheduled episode, I think.
That's right. We're talking to her in a couple of weeks' time. Really looking forward to that.
And then... when we really start getting back into the swing of it, because I'm off on another German trip next weekend. So we're driving to Alex's again, and then we're going to have a 3-week road trip around Bavaria.
Mm-hmm.
So
nice.
Doing that southern German thing could be versed. And then,
Yes. Then
what we're going to do is we're going to come back. And Sue and I have had this idea that we'd quite like to spend a lot more time out there. So Germany would not really be the ideal place, but being close to the German border would be great. So we're actually going to go and scope out this little place that we found in the Alsace, which is just on the German-French border.
Nice.
So when we get back from that, we'll get properly into the podcasting swing of things again and get some really good guests lined up.
I've got a few ideas, and people normally say yes, which is really good.
Yeah, no, it is good. So, yeah, that's been my kind of, you know, summer recap, really. Germany, cameras, dicking around with my website.
And your irrigation system.
And soon to be my impressive irrigation system, exactly. Just before the
hosepipe. We all need one at our age.
Yeah, it's much harder to get decent water pressure these days than it used to be.
Yeah, it certainly is.
I remember when you used to be able to turn on the tap and the water would just gush out. And now, you know, now you can barely get a trickle.
That's right.
Right, well, should we wrap it up?
On that bombshell.
Well, listen, great to see you. And we'll catch up in a couple of weeks with Veronica. I'm going to take my microphone with me as when we go on this trip so we can do some episodes during kind of August, September, if you're free. But so, yeah, thanks for that.
No, it's cool. I'm looking forward to it and it's great to chat again.
Thanks for listening, everyone, and we will see you on the next one.
See you next time.